Hi, and welcome back to the podcast. Today, I'm very excited to be interviewing Baylissa Frederick, who is a psychotherapist, a coach, and an author with 2 decades of experience working with people from all over the world. She's involved in helping people affected by antidepressants, tranquilizers, and opiate, physical dependence, and withdrawal. She delivers keynote speeches on the subject, has provided awareness presentations to organizations including the British Medical Association and the Royal College of Psychiatrists, and offers training workshops to psychotherapists and counselors. She has been interviewed and quoted by newspapers and journals including the London Times, the Independent, and the British Medical Association News. Baylissa is the author of the internationally successful self-help book, Recovery and Renewal, the memoir With Hope in My Heart, and 2 journals, Dearest Me and Dearest Friend. She was prescribed a benzodiazepine, clonazepam, for a form of dystonia, which is an involuntary movement disorder, and survived an intense withdrawal experience when coming off of it. She is now fully recovered and is dedicated to this cause. I really hope you enjoy this interview and find it very informative. And remember, stay tuned after the interview for our post-show discussion. Welcome, Baylissa. I have been waiting to get you on the show, and I'm so excited to have you here today.
Thank you, Geraldine. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be here and, you know, to speak with you. We go way back, and yeah, thank you very much.
Well, you know, many people know you as the calm voice of hope, and when they're recovering from harm from a benzodiazepine, many, if they haven't read your book, might not know what led you to be prescribed a benzo. Can you tell us what happened in your life that you were prescribed one?
Yes, certainly. I have a condition called dystonia, which is an involuntary movement condition where my head goes to the right and my body sort of has spasms, first down my face and down my neck. And I've had this since age 3, varying degrees of intensity. And when I grew up in the Caribbean, when I came to the UK to study many decades ago, it got worse. I don't know if it was the climate, but I went to my doctor, you know, just saying I was proposed to by my fiancé after having been here for some time. And I went to the doctor, you know, sort of saying this is really a problem. And he prescribed first Tegretol, and that made me very sleepy. I was a student at the time, and I went back to him a few days after to say, I can't take this. You know, it's making me zombie-like. And he said, okay, this is clonazepam, which is known as Clonopin in the US and Rivotril in the UK. He said, this is Rivotril, he actually said. It's 0.5 milligrams. It's a child's dosage. This will certainly help. And that's how I got, that's how I started taking it. And I took it for 8 months.
And no warning?
No, nothing like that. Yeah, he just said, it's a child's dosage. You know, nothing, it's really nothing, which we know now that that dose is equivalent to 10 milligrams of diazepam. And I ended up on 1.5 milligrams, which is equivalent to 30 milligrams of diazepam.
Oh, and how many years?
8, just under 8 years, 7.5, going on 8 years by repeat prescription.
Right. And then what was your aha moment that you thought, I think it's the meds making me sick, and how did you even come about tapering? Because most of us had no information back then.
I know. So I, after about 3 months on the drug, it stopped working. It didn't stop the episodes completely in the beginning, but it greatly improved them. And I was very, very happy about that. When it stopped working, I threw the bottle in the bin. I'd never forget, in the rubbish bin in my bedroom. And 3 days after, I had what was like a grand mal seizure. And I was at home, and I remember rummaging through the bin taking out the Rivotril and taking it and thinking, oh my gosh, I've developed some sort of epilepsy. I need this drug. When I went to my doctor, he said, oh, no, you can't stop taking it. You need to take it for the rest of your life. So I took it and I started getting very spaced out, very zombie-like. I developed what I now know was quite severe depersonalization and derealization, terrible cognitive fog. And I started getting lost when I was driving. And one day I couldn't find where I lived. And I kept driving around in circles, sort of, is this where I live? When I did find my front door, I went straight to the computer and I typed in the generic name. So I typed in clonazepam and all these websites came up saying, buy cheap clonopin. And I remember just going cold and thinking, oh my gosh, I'm on an addictive drug. And I spent hours on that computer until I found your baby, which is the Ashton Manual. And thank you very much, because we know we wouldn't have it had it not been for you. And of course, Professor Ashton. And I found that Ashton Manual and I read everything, you know, to do with the symptoms and tolerance. And I just, the tears just, you know, streamed down my face. The following morning, I printed it off and took it to my GP. And I said, look, doctor, I found out what's wrong with me. I'm in benzodiazepine withdrawal. And yeah, that was the beginning of my recovery.
Right. This is why I always say you are the perfect person to be counseling people, because not only do you have degrees, but you have the experience. And boy, if anybody wanted to know if they were treated in, you know, not the right way coming off, you have experienced it. So can you tell me a little bit about your professional background, you know, and then what came first, the book or to decide to do the benzo counseling? And I know time has gone by here because you had to recover too.
Yeah, so I actually trained as a therapist. I started my training in 1998. I started practicing in 2001. All of this was when I was on the drug, but not as ill as I eventually became. And so I worked with domestic violence. That was my main thing, women and children experiencing domestic violence. I worked with an agency in Cardiff. I also had a private practice where I worked for the National Health Service. And eventually, as I lost my cognition, I did give up counseling and I worked with, I remember going to work in a call center with the Royal College of Nursing, because that was all I could do mentally. And that was just before I went through withdrawal. So when I recovered, Well, the first thing was that when I was going through it, I couldn't find anything that gave me hope. I mean, other than the Ashton Manual, there was nothing. There were some books, but I found that I was more terrified after reading them. So I just started, you know, writing what was then called BenzoWise. And that was the book I published in 2009. It's now been republished as Recovery and Renewal. This working with people in withdrawal was sort of by default. I was blacklisted as a therapist who was trying to take people off antidepressants and benzodiazepines. So I couldn't get any work at all. So I was doing all my withdrawal work, you know, just voluntarily without pay. But I was also basically homeless with no income. I was on government benefits. I used to get £80 per week. And that's basically how I lived for many years. And eventually I went back to counseling and just ended up working with people affected by withdrawal, but as a coach, not as a therapist.
Right, which we're so grateful to have you doing it, because people need that one-on-one coaching. It's especially where doctors still don't get it, and even therapists don't. But some are starting to learn, and we're very grateful that that's slowly happening.
And we did, just to say, Geraldine, we did work with Luke Montague, the Council for Evidence-Based Psychiatry, and the All-Parliamentary Party Group. We did a guidance document for therapists here in the UK. And I also sometimes train. I've done training workshops for counselors here as well. So we're trying to give them the knowledge that they need to be able to work with people in withdrawal.
Well, you know, speaking of all these other people, I had some notes here because the UK is so far ahead of us. And I don't understand why it isn't taking off in other countries, because I'll mention somebody like Shirley Trickett, who, you know, we'll get into some of the things she said before, but, you know, you've got Dr. Reg Perrott, who ran Victims of Tranquilizers, Barry Haslam, you know, chair of Oldham, Peter Ritson, and the late Pam Armstrong, who started CETA, which is Council for Involuntary Tranquilizer Addiction, Val Stevens, who started Bristol Tranquilizer Group, Sue Bibby, who even I've lost touch with, who had Ben's Act. And she, you know, that's no longer. And that was for pregnant mothers or children who had been given benzos, because I had to reach out to her as we were finding people that were drugged when they were children. The late, you know, Una Corbett, who I loved, who ran Battle Against Tranquilizers, Melanie Davis from Rest, you know, and Luke Montague, as you mentioned. What do you, I mean, the UK has, and all these organizations, and there's been a lot done. There's still nothing going on worldwide. What do you think the tie-up is? I have my views of why it's not catching on. I think they're too afraid because there's so many people on these drugs and they're not going to be able to handle it.
I think that acknowledgement of the problem is admitting responsibility. And there is a lot of patient blaming, even in our own quest for change of policy and so on. Very often we have to, you know, sort of, we have to be adamant about not being labeled substance misusers and, you know, all of these issues that stand in the way. I think that because many people are prescribed the drugs for depression or anxiety, it's very easy to say that the issues being experienced are related to the pre-existing, you know, condition. So that's another, that's like a little loophole where, you know, if you look at with the opioid crisis, they couldn't attribute the symptoms to, you know, anxiety or depression. It's to pain. Yeah, the reason for being prescribed the drug. We didn't have that. We don't have that. So it's very easy to cop out and to say that, oh, you know, these, quote unquote, these people are just, you know, they probably have a predisposition to addiction and, you know, they're mentally troubled people. So there's that.
And, you know, And Beatrice Foss' book, Benzo Junkie, I read it years ago. And one of the things she stresses in that it's always blame the patient, don't blame the drug. And I hate to even say this, but I'm gonna, because I've always said it. If this comes out, our doctors are fully educated on what these drugs are doing to people. Once they give that first prescription with no informed consent, they've got a patient for a very long time. So you're going to cut down on their pocketbooks, you know, and that bothers me a lot, because they're just giving it out with no thought whatsoever for the patient or to ever get them better. Because same with, you know, my doctor used to say to me, you know, oh, no, you need to take these for the rest of your life. Even at one point when I was getting better, she discouraged me. And actually handed me a prescription and told me to take it for the rest of my life. So I'm hoping it will change. I feel like it will eventually, but we've been fighting for a very long time.
Yeah, there is that sort of unbelievability factor. Just to say that I've had so many doctors in withdrawal, including psychiatrists, you know, that I've supported who were just as baffled and shocked. I'm not, you know, saying that every doctor is innocent, but there are some who were just blindsided, you know, by the withdrawal experience and just couldn't believe it.
Right. I same thing. Same thing here. I've had doctors sick.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They were also blindsided. I mean, they were shocked, the ones that I've talked to over the years, the doctors, nurses, therapists. You know, it's happened to them. And there was one of our girls, she used to be a moderator in my group. She actually was a therapist in a rehab where people were coming in. And she said to the doctor one day, "I think I'm sicker than them. And I'm just taking Klonopin to help me sleep at night." She said, "I'm sicker than all of them." And she had to start weaning. So it is a lack of education. And that's one of the things I'd like to do over here, is try to start working on the education, you know, but we've got so much out there on the internet, you know?
Yes.
One of the things I want to mention, you know, over the years, you and I have seen a lot of suffering. So we've seen people, I know I had a few that I thought would never recover, go on to lead wonderful lives. And and there are always those that are sick longer than others. And I was one of them, because it took me a long time to heal. My gut was harmed by the drugs, and I needed to heal that. And then also genetically, I found out that I wasn't born with everything you need to detoxify properly. Mm-hmm. And even Shirley Trickett, you know, who wrote one of the benzo books, she said that in her updated version, if you want better in 3 years, you need to look at other issues. You know, for instance, she mentioned Lyme, you know, Borrelia, Bartonella, thyroid issues, you know, different things can develop as a result, or you don't know. What's your opinion on that? Because we have seen others that found out they had Lyme or thyroid issues.
Yeah, I had thyroid issues. I dealt with mine differently because, well, at the time we had much less knowledge than we have now. I've always been someone who took supplements, and, you know, I had maybe one of the first functional medicine doctors. But when I got better, my tongue was swelling, my throat was swelling, my tongue was serrated. And I went to a specialist here in the UK who confirmed that my thyroid was underactive. I treated mine naturally, and it's back to normal now. I think that my only thing is that no one size fits all. So I've seen people heal with concurrent issues, but I've seen people stay stuck in protracted groups because they won't go check for, you know, deficiencies and, you know, finding out what else could be wrong. So, but I've never really just said everybody experiences something because of the same issue. I've seen where different issues can cause, you know, protracted experiences. But I do believe it's important to get things checked, you know, have your diagnostics, get deficiencies addressed.
I remember
I'm not sure I've answered the question.
Yeah, and no, you did, because that's the whole point. We are not a one size fits all. And I remember I was having a conversation once with Professor Malcolm Later, and he always says, you know, he refers to his paper, The History of Benzodiazepines, but he said, you know, you can have a person that took a benzodiazepine for 20 years and get off and be fine in 2 months, and somebody who took it for 2 months and it takes them 2 years to recover. So we are all genetically different. That's, we all lead different lives, different stresses. And that's on the groups, I think, that you try to get across. It's giving hope, which is free. You know, we're all going to do things differently.
Yes.
So no, you hit that right on the nail. We are all different. It's not a one size fits all.
Yes.
So here's the thing that a lot of people want to get us to say different things, but some people choose to take another medication with their symptoms, and that's their choice. We can't tell somebody to do. Mm-hmm. We're not living their lives. For instance, nerve pain. When somebody has nerve pain, you know, I didn't get that particular symptom, but I know that a lot of the drugs that are being given to benzo people are usually gabapentin or Lyrica.
Yes.
Or some decide to take an antidepressant. We're not leading their lives. Some have said they were glad they did it, and then they weaned off. Others did it. It helped them to get through a while, and then they regretted doing it. So again, we can't tell people what to do. So what do you do when somebody tries to corner you? I mean, I don't criticize anybody.
Okay.
I don't like that online when people say never take anything. Sure, would it be nice if we could all make it through? I did make it through without taking anything. I wished I could have, but I didn't. I thought, I'm not going to. But we can't tell people what to do.
I don't. I get people almost every day trying to get me. I have one basic answer, so much so that if somebody says, oh, Baylissa told me to, everybody says, no, she didn't, because we've been trying. Yeah. I always just say, look, there are three possible outcomes. One, that it works. One, that it makes no difference, or it could make you worse. It just depends. There's no way of knowing. I think it's important to weigh the pros and the cons. I don't believe, you know, that somebody who is suffering to the point where that person is suicidal, you know, should just avoid, because there is a lot of pressure in the group. So don't take anything. And I have seen people who have controlled symptoms with other drugs and then tapered off and they're fine. I mean, I've seen lots of people over the years. I really think it's an individual choice.
And that's what I tell them too. Yeah.
And a lot depends on the medic. I think somebody who has a good doctor who understands withdrawal is really at an advantage. And I've seen those doctors work with people, you know, take them off. Some people have been having serious seizure type, you know, movements and so on, who are put on drugs to control that and then are taken off and they're fine. You know?
Right, right. Yeah. So as we're talking about this, I had Millie Key from april.org.uk on the show before. And years ago when Millie and I were talking, you know, she had said, you know, there's going to be these genetic tests that are going to be available within the next 5 years. And well, we're way past 5 years since her and I had that conversation. But, you know, I've seen some people now, they can go get this specific genetic testing, and it tests for which benzo, which antidepressants their bodies can handle.
Yeah.
And it's actually making a difference. I wish all psychiatrists would do that before they drug somebody, and not even just the psychiatrist, but I've seen some do better. They'll switch to the benzo that it, that test shows, and they're able to taper better. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's a
P450, you know, so they'll know how they've metabolized the Valium and so on. And you're right, it is making a huge difference.
It is making a difference. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I hope as these years go by, this is something that will be done for everybody struggling when you're on a med, you know, it's, and then some will switch to, I've seen some go from dry cutting to water titration to a liquid. You know, they'll find the one that works best for them, or some switch at the end to a water titration. So there's many different ways to make it off of this without suffering, you know?
Exactly. And I've seen people argue about which tapering method is best. And, you know, I say, look, it's trial and error and what works for one person. You know, so it's just getting that. There's a lot of subjectivity online with people sort of saying, no, don't do that. I did it and this happened. But, you know, you can't really say that because somebody else might, you know, people go on about maybe the Ashton method, and yes, it's too rushed for some people, and others do really well on it. Some people water titrate better, some people switch to that, they're not doing so well. You know, it really is no one size fits all.
Right. And, you know, after Heather had written that, you got to remember, she wrote that for me years ago. She actually, was it when Canada, there was a conference going on, and she said to me once, she said, I think that water titration method is very interesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that had come out years after the manual. And the other thing, and I try to always stress this when I do a show, she didn't want that the manual used like a lawnmower manual, as she used those words, because she said, you know, she in there, it's every 2 weeks. That's a lot for some people. And I know some of the organizations in the UK say every like 3 to 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the dose you're on. And that's where people have to go by how they're feeling, what's going on
exactly.
in their lives.
So she always said that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. So when people are very ill and they're struggling mentally and physically, one of the biggest questions, and we see this online too with everybody, is, you know, their diet. I mean, do you even advise people how to eat? Because I just try to keep it basic. I don't tell anybody what to do.
No, it's like, no, I don't at all. Because I've seen people become completely obsessed and paranoid, and they're down to eating two things because somebody had tomatoes and the glutamate caused this, and this one had broccoli, and before you know it, they've eliminated everything. So I try to just say, look, eat as healthily as you can. I do sort of question whether they have alcohol or caffeine or, you know, the things that we know can interfere with healing. And then, you know, it's just a matter of being sensible, you know, of course, not having sugar laden foods and, you know, the MSG and so on. And then just eat. I've seen actually one of the most remarkable cases I've seen. We were talking about it recently. He couldn't cook, so he used to go to the chip shop or have them deliver fries, what you all call French fries. Yeah. For his entire withdrawal, he ate fried potatoes every night. I'm not saying at all this is a good diet, but he healed perfectly, you know.
Well, there you go.
I know.
Wow. Well, you know, and again, there was this one woman I talked to, and she was so ill she couldn't do anything, and her husband was doing the cooking, and he, well, for a guy, and some men can cook very well, he fed her terrible, and she was still pretty sick. So I said, look, as soon as you get a little better, you know, take control of the diet. I just basically say like a paleo whole 30, pretty clean diet, you know, again, but if somebody wants to do their own thing. I was against vegetarian diets because I got very sick doing it, and I've seen others do it. Mm-hmm. But another person who was vegetarian, she just did it, but made sure she was getting her protein in, and that made the difference. And she did wonderful.
Yeah.
So it's everybody, your diet's in your own hands. So
exactly.
Another thing is, what is the... Yeah, exactly. So what is the best method you do suggest to people to try to calm them as they're dealing with their symptoms, like yoga, walking, swimming, meditation, mindfulness? Right. Do you get into any of that?
I do. Oh, yeah, that's my thing is about coping and how best can each person cope. Now, of course, again, with no one size fits all, some people say, oh, I can't meditate, or, you know, some people are too symptomatic to do any sort of physical activity. But I still encourage them to even do a bit of, you know, just even a leisurely walk, or even to sit in the garden, you know, be out in nature, breathing techniques. A mindfulness approach I find is very, very useful in terms of not fighting the withdrawal. Because I've seen people just every day is full of angst. You know, this needs to stop. And you know, just sort of so much resistance. Whereas someone else who has the same symptoms but will practice, you know, maybe accepting or allowing whatever is happening to happen can have a much easier ride. So a lot of what
that's good
I
advice.
Do, yeah, has to do with using not mindfulness as in a mindfulness meditation, but a mindfulness approach which is based on acceptance.
Right. I think that's great advice, because even I was so agoraphobic, I would just try to walk around my house. So I tell people when they're sick, just walk around the perimeter of your house. Or I just went out in the backyard. I had never gardened in my life. And I thought, OK, I can be in my backyard. And I started gardening, and I still do it to this day.
Gardening is brilliant. You know, so any sort of healthy, I call it distraction, but you're not distracting to fight what's happening. You're distracting because, you know, it helps to pass the day. It helps to add structure to the day. So even some people volunteer online, like they may write to sick children, or, you know, there's so many things a person can do that, you know, is a part of coping or can be added to the coping toolbox. So some people get into coloring and watercolor painting and, you know, knitting, cross stitching, you know, all of these things can be seen as coping tools.
Absolutely. Distraction is wonderful. Get your mind off of your symptoms. I remember the thing I did, we had all these family recipes, and I sat and I typed every single one, and we have that family cookbook now, but it kept my mind off of thinking about every symptom. So it's really important to do something. to distract yourself.
It is.
So
I'm
great advice.
Take breaks, Geraldine. I don't know about you, but I know when I was going through withdrawal, and I think it's the same for you, because we didn't have Facebook and, you know, social media was not what it is now. We tended to have less of this vicarious distress. I know we had like the Yahoo groups and Benzo Island and so on started up, but there wasn't this, we didn't spend all day, you know, comparing notes and everybody freaking each other out. So I encourage people to take breaks from the internet, because
me too.
It's all energy. And, you know, when everybody's desperate, there's no sort of focus on recovery. It's all, you know, who has the worst symptoms and, you know, that sort of thing.
Yep. The having these support groups online are wonderful, but yes, you do need to protect yourself. Mm-hmm. It's good to know that what you're experiencing is normal, but it's not good to be looking at it all the time. So that is correct.
You're right.
Now let's get, so one of the, you and I were left in charge of Professor Ashton's manual, you know, when she got sick. So we are the gatekeepers of the manual, but we also have her son, John, thank God, now when we want to go to John with something. Yes. So for many years, I only had a telephone relationship with her, never got to know in person. I actually had the chance one time, she was speaking here in Maine and I was supposed to speak at it, but I still wasn't feeling great and couldn't do it. And then she was visiting a cousin about a half an hour from me, and it was horrible weather. But you knew her in person. And one of the things I would like is for you to give people a sense of her, because she was just the most wonderful, sweet, caring, and knowledgeable person.
She really was. I mean, I still, you know, get a little bit emotional just knowing she's gone. But so my history with her was that when I was writing, I didn't know her when I was going through my own withdrawal. But when I thought of writing Benzo Wise, I got in touch with her and she was lovely. She just said, oh, send me all the, you know, she looked at the whole book, but she also vetted the medical information and, you know, really helped me to make sure that I didn't write anything that was inaccurate or, you know, contradictory. So we sort of struck up a friendship around that time, and I just remember her being so supportive, not just with the book, but she, just to say a little bit about her personality, she was not just caring, she had a brilliant sense of humor, and she loved, because, you know, I am single, so she loved all the little dating escapades and, you know, any sort of boyfriend talks. I'd call her and I'd say, oh, I'm going on a date. You know, she'd say, ooh, you know, tell me more. And, you know, so sometimes we chat maybe 3-4 times per week. And when she developed the COPD, I remember sometimes we'd chat for so long. She'd say, oh, Billis, I can't breathe. I'll call you back later, you know. And that was the kind of friendship we had. And that was before I even met her. Then I went to, we both spoke at a British Medical Association conference. So that was when I met her. And I remember almost squeezing the life out of her, because I was so excited to finally meet her, you know?
Right,
and she was
right. And that, you know,
lovely.
Very lovely. Always so charming and lovely. And like you said, she would get to know things going on in my life. And sometimes I feel bad because as we brought her out into the public, people from all over the world would email her, and she felt an obligation to write back to everybody. And it was getting to be a lot on her before she retired. And that is how genuine she was, that she wanted to reply. And then even kind of little fights that went on the internet, she would say, all right, you know, handle that. And
yes,
she really, what an amazing woman. What doctor would get that involved and be that caring and that kind? And that's why I feel it's important we protect her legacy.
Oh, she's amazing. And I tell you what, her children are just like her. they say the apples don't fall far from the tree. She, John is an amazing gentleman. Just the word is dignified. They are so gracious, you know. And
every one of his letters reflects that. His I write quick, and his letters are beautiful.
Just like her. Excellent writer and orator. Yeah. So I attended the funeral. So I met everyone then, you know, all the grandchildren and the kids, all, you know, that she'd spoken about over the years. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it was a sad occasion, but also a celebration of her life that turned out to be a really feel-good, happy day in that sense. Right. And I think it's because of the legacy she's left with us.
Wow. I know we were invited over to the funeral. My son said, let's go. We'll just fly over. We'll stay, you know, and then come back in a couple of days. And I'm like, no, we're not going to go. And plus I didn't want to leave my husband here, but I think, you know, just for you to give that sense of her, I think people will understand when they read that manual, have a sense of who she was as a woman.
Yes. And so, she was very fit. Well into her 80s. She played tennis.
Yeah, she used to call it squash, right? She played squash?
She played
squash. Is that like similar?
And tennis. She loved, because we used to watch Wimbledon together, as in we'd watch the matches and then call each other after to discuss. So she loved her tennis.
Wow.
Yeah, and
that's
painting.
Funny.
She painted, and she was a brilliant writer. So she wrote short stories. You know, and she would send, the short stories.
Well, she obviously is a writer, because when I asked her to write for the book I was doing, I expected like 3-4 pages to come over. Instead, comes over 3 chapters that now become the Ashton Manual. I was shocked.
Yeah.
And, you know, whenever I would do the putting together the money that the manual makes, I would, you know, send it over to her. And this is, again, I want people to see what she was like as a woman. She would say to me, oh, do you mind if I use a little bit of the money for myself? I'm like, you should use it all for yourself, because I know back then she was donating a lot of it back into the benzo cause, like to Bristol Tranquilizer, I know was one of the places she gave it. And then when she was only working part-time and then retired, she would say, do you mind if I keep a little? I just thought I wanted to do this. I wanted to be able, she wanted to be able to get a taxi or something to go into the office. I said, you use that all for yourself.
Yes.
No, you know, that's the type of woman she was. So one of the things I want to mention while we're doing this, and some of it might not be coming in clear, because we are doing this while the coronavirus is going on worldwide. And mm-hmm. I would say, you know, we're at a stay-at-home orders, and I think it's going on mostly worldwide. So the one thing on the internet that we see all the time is how many of us were stuck in our houses for years. So we see kind of, I've seen on the internet people saying, well, now people are going to get a taste of what my life is like. And we see other people who are being stay at home for the first time ever, trying to do things to, not go stir crazy. And I hope at this time that people will reach out to those that are suffering, and vice versa. Those of us that have suffered for years, we actually can tell people how to stay at home and entertain themselves.
Experts,
but what are your thoughts on this? You know, we became experts on being isolated.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this? Because I'm sure a lot of benzo people are fearful and petrified during the virus. We want to calm them down.
Yes, so they are. I've had two sorts of responses. Well, three. Some people, the people who are maybe the ones who are suffering the most, and I know they don't mean it, but they've been saying, oh, I hope I get it, as a way out. And I'm like, no, you don't. You know, your prognosis is great, so don't say that. But I know it's a sort of defiance because of the, you know, the Groundhog Day type of suffering. Then we have others who are just petrified that they're going to get it. So I just try to point out to them that many people who have it aren't even symptomatic, you know, that the and a lot of them think that because they're riddled with symptoms, it puts them at risk. And I try to explain that, look, this is an issue to do with your receptors. You know, you do not have underlying, you know, an underlying heart condition, or you haven't had a stroke, you know. So just trying to put it into perspective that, no, you're not as susceptible as you think you are, you know, in the event that you should get it. And we know that there are people who, you know, supposedly young and fit who have gotten it and have been very unwell. But we still know that in Italy, where the rate is so high, they're mostly in their 80s and, you know, late 70s. So I just sort of try to tell them the practicalities. And of course, the most important thing is that they've been self-isolating anyway, so they're not coming into contact with people who are symptomatic. And if they do have family members who are working and at risk, then, you know, just keep your, you know, do the distancing and the hygiene stuff, and they should be okay. So I don't know of anyone at the moment in withdrawal who has contracted it. I'm not saying I know everybody, but so far I haven't heard of anyone. And I think people in withdrawal should consider themselves actually much safer, especially the people who are housebound or are housebound, much safer than, you know, others.
Right. I agree. I agree. Because I have one person, she keeps texting me and she's like, I'm so afraid. Aren't you afraid? I said, no, you know, I'm not afraid. We're doing everything we're supposed to do. You've got to calm down. And and that's all we can do, is for those that are petrified. And so that's why we're mentioning during the virus, because so many people are on the internet, we're not always getting a clear connection on this. But so before we sign off, Baylissa, are there any final words of encouragement to anybody listening? I know people just love to hear your voice because it's so calm. And this is your chance to give them those final words of encouragement as they're going through withdrawal.
Yeah, I just want to say to anyone listening that, you know, if I haven't been doing this as long as Geraldine, but this is my 15th year. And when I started, there were people who were very protracted, who thought they wouldn't heal, and who would say, oh, some of us don't get better, and they got better. And so I always say to anyone in withdrawal, just keep telling yourself that you're going to heal, you know, that everyone heals. I also want to say that, I don't know if you know Dr. Wright, Geraldine, but I traveled to
Vancouver. I've talked to him.
Yeah. I went to see Dr. Wright in Vancouver, and I said, look, am I wrong in encouraging people to, you know, to believe that they're going to get better? And he said, Baylissa, everyone heals. And he sort of went into the whole, you know, the medical, the scientific workings of neuroplasticity, and that he mentioned, you know, even people who were brain damaged from things like anesthesia, that eventually one part of the brain will assume the functions of the damaged part. And, you know, he was really adamant, and he said, you can quote me on this, because, you know, he has been doing it for decades. And he said, everyone heals. So I just encourage people, instead of focusing on, you know, I know people who go just looking for the most protracted cases, and then they freak themselves out that that's going to be them. And while we can't ever predict how long someone is going to take, I would just say, you know, just focus on getting better. Treat your body, you know, with all the care that you can. You know, eat healthily. Be careful what you feed your mind with in terms of what you spend your days doing, you know, so you healthily distract and you wait it out. And you, if you have deficiencies or you have some concurrent medical issue, you deal with it, or you deal with them, and just keep the be gentle with yourself in terms of what you tell yourself. So you wouldn't scare someone you love dearly by saying, oh, you're not going to get better, you know, you're doomed, all these things. So don't tell yourself those things. Speak to yourself as you would to someone you love dearly. Yeah, that's so important.
Excellent, excellent words.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit, you know, maybe people think I'm a little bit woo-woo, but those are very, very important practices, the self-compassion and self-kindness.
Right. Those are excellent words of encouragement, and I want to thank you so much for being on. I know you are very scheduled and busy all day,
and I really appreciate
you coming on today.
And thank you.
Thank you so much, Baylissa.
Thank you for being there and just, you know, being the backbone of the community. Okay, we love you. Okay.
Love you too. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.
All right, Garrett, we just finished the interview with Baylissa, which I love because she is just very well known in the benzo community. And I know you had never heard me really talk much about her because a lot of that goes on online. But back in 2009, when Dad had his heart attack, Baylissa had sent me over her first book that she wrote, and I had never had time to read it. And I sat in the hospital room and I read her whole book. I remember for years people would say to me, oh, you need to finish your book. You need to finish your book. And once I read hers, I thought, nope, I don't have to do anything. She did a fantastic job in her book of giving people hope and saying what had happened to her and that you do recover. So I thought her interview was very good in giving. That's what we always needed, was that constant hope. I think you saw that over the years when I was sick, too, that I needed hope and encouragement.
Yeah, I think the portion of the interview that stuck out the most is she used the word hope, that when she first started, she had no hope. There was nothing that told her that she was going to get better. And I mean, from her closing words, you can see that she has built up the knowledge that she knows that there's hope, that there's hope for everybody.
Right. Right. And there can be something wrong if somebody isn't recovering as fast as they think. First of all, sometimes it takes time for the brain to heal. But like myself, I had the Ativan had harmed my gut. I had to heal my gut. And genetically, I needed to just slowly do things with my liver to assist it, not cleanse it. That would be too painful. You know, people sometimes try different things and then they get sick, which they were probably doing the right thing, but they needed to go very, very slow. So her words of encouragement. And I also think where she had that personal relationship with Professor Ashton, I like that she could give people a sense of Professor Ashton, who she and I absolutely adored.
Yeah. So again, I never had any interaction with Dr. Ashton or her son now, but that seems to be the person that everybody's missing now. So the fact that there is like that, another way of touching that knowledge is great.
Yeah, I wanted people to really not just read her manual, but I wanted people to have that sense of who she was. And she was one of the most kind, loving, interesting women I think I ever met. And she really has left a beautiful legacy behind. But what her work did was bring validation. And that's the greatest gift she could have given to all of us, was to validate that what we go through is real. And that was the start of, over these, you know, last 20 years, to bring that information out, which so many people, when their doctors don't believe them, you know, it brought that validation that they needed, that they know what they're going through is real.
Yeah. So, yeah, I thought it was a really good interview.
Yeah.
But I think what we should talk about right now is, so we are still during the coronavirus.
Yeah, we are.
Breakout.
Yep.
We're now, so we're a couple weeks away from the first time we talked about it. I think it just started the first, that when we had done an interview, a post show.
Yeah.
How are you feeling now that we're in week three of stay at home?
As Baylissa said, we know what being stay at home orders are. I was stuck in the house for a very long time. So for me, I mean, do I miss running out doing errands? Yes, because that was very social for me to run into people that I know, but I'm okay with it.
You've been doing it on walks.
I was going
to
say,
everybody on a walk.
We are out doing walks every day. You have me out there every day. You go a lot longer than me, but, you know, I'm out there every day. And sometimes when we're out for that walk, I always think, I couldn't even walk to the corner. Could not even walk to the corner. And we are the house on the corner. Couldn't get there and back. That was overwhelming. My body was so ill. And now we're... I do about what, a mile with you, and then you're off doing four more after me, only because I want to get back and get some things done. So it's a good time for people to...
Right, not because you're getting tired or anything.
Yeah, no, yeah, I am. Yeah. I'm done. I got to get good sneakers. I don't know. But, and then we go out again at night. So come on, add that to my mileage I'm doing.
You do have a night one, too.
I do have the night one, and I think... So if somebody wants to think I can never do that again, I couldn't even go to the food store years ago, and I can do that now. So when that, kind of when I fell and broke my pelvis and I was stuck in the house again, what was the first thing? I think the only time I cried was that I was back stuck in the house. I hated that. But now,
I think the difference there, though, it's like when you have these physical ailments, like the pelvis break that you had, you know you're going to get better. You didn't, like, you don't necessarily know when you have things going on in your brain. You just think, oh, my God, I'm going crazy.
Right. And you don't know when that's going to end. I kind of had an idea when the pelvis would end, but it was still, it was, like I said, I'm used to it. I know what it feels like. And, you know, I'm out, you know, we're talking to people when we're outside. You want to keep walking, so we keep our cardio up. But, hey, you know, right now it's the time to enjoy people. I hope others will reach out to benzo people that are homesick. But Baylissa gave great, great information, and I'm so glad we finally got her on the show. But between now that we're all stuck at home, my schedule is pretty much open, but we had to wait for you. And so now that you're around all the time, you're the only person that we really can have in the house. So other than that, it's outside conversations. And so not only a sense of Professor Ashton, I hope others that have never talked to Baylissa have that sense of her, to read her books, to get to know her, look at her website.
What's the name of her book again?
Well, we're going to put a listing of some of the books, but her website is baylissa.com. So, you know, she mentioned that her first book was Benzo Wise. And that was the first book that I read. It was, the whole title was Benzo Wise, A Recovery Companion. And then when she redid it, it was called Recovery and Renewal with Hope in My Heart is a memoir, you know, and Dearest Me, A Journal for Nurturing Yourself with Gentle Kindness and Compassion. Those are all the books that she's written. So
we mentioned it during the interview, but she's getting her PhD right now, right?
She is getting her PhD right now. She is.
And that's kind of the reason that we had to schedule it for a certain time, because she is so busy right now.
She's busy, and she's also still counseling, you know, coaching people. She doesn't counsel. She is coaching benzo people right now. So, yeah, that was, you know, right now anywhere in the world we can be interviewing people. So I'm hoping we get a few more of our international people. We've had a list for a long time, and you know, we are lucky in one sense that we have this time, we can get them done and get them out there. So I think another fantastic show. And I want to thank you again for helping.
Thank you.